Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and I'm here with my good friend Josh Zagorin, who accompanies me on these long journeys of horror adventures. Hi, Josh.
Hey, how are you? How is everybody?
And we're here with special guest horror royalty, Joe Alves, the production designer for Jaws. Yes, he made Bruce. And Dennis Prince, the author, film historian, who is Joe's biographer and, I'm going to say, aficionado of all things Jaws related. So welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Joe, I have to say, Jaws is probably in my top three favorite movies of all time. I saw it in the theater when I was 10 years old, and I was fascinated by creature features ever since.
It does live on, you know. It's amazing. It 45 years. I started on it 47 years ago, so that's quite a span of time that it still has such popularity.
Well, it's amazing too that I don't think a lot of people also remember that you kind of created a look of an iconic look that kind of carried not through Jaws but through Close Encounters and Escape from New York. Like, you kind of shaped a lot of what we now take as classic horror and sci-fi. And so I'm curious to hear what you think the impetus behind that is now. Like, what about it was so special? Why did it change people's minds like that?
It was an interesting time. Of course, the 70s, there were a lot of, you know, very interesting movies at the time, the Godfather series. And what I have found, a lot of people that were very young, a lot of people that are like 50, 55, Greg Nicotero, who's very big Jaws fan, he's 55. Dennis, who wrote the book, he's what, 50? You're the same age as Dennis. And I just had a long conversation with Kevin Smith, who's 50, you know, who's made a lot of movies.
Right.
And so the interesting thing, they were inspired by that period, and it shows later in their film production. But the idea that Jaws, Close Encounters, and Escape from New York was sort of an interesting, quite different, three quite different films, you
right.
know, for many reasons. First of all, Jaws was a small shark movie the studio really didn't want to make. The effects department at Universal. And let me just explain this. We were in the studio system, and at that time, through the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, everything was done in-house. And all the various, you know, Paramount, MGM, Warner Brothers, Universal. And so you got hired on in the art department as a junior set designer or illustrator. You worked your way up to art director, but everything was kept in-house. When we were presenting my illustrations based on the gallery sheets to the effects department in Universal, they said, oh, they couldn't make it. It's going to take a year and a half, blah, blah, blah. So the head of production, Marsha Green, said, find some people to make it and take it off the lot. And that was very unusual. So
wow.
It was a very, very small movie. By contrast, Close Encounters, the whole of the conversation, that started as a small sci-fi movie. And then Steven and I sort of escalated it. And with the popularity of Jaws, it gave us some credibility. So anyway, I'll let you ask the questions. Or Dennis, you want to jump in there?
No, actually, Joe, you know, okay, so I'll talk, you know, since he mentioned, you know, I'm of that generation who was inspired, and Summer, you are as well, and Josh, I imagine you are too. For me, Jaws was just that film. You have in your life that film. What's your favorite film? Boom, Jaws. It came at the right time. I was 12 years old, saw it in the theater. There's a little story about my experience with it in the book. And it just forever, you know, kind of just it just set the tone for me as far as my love for film, trying to understand more about film. And as you'll see, I think through the design of the book itself, and I won't go too deep into this yet, but it's very intentional. It is to a degree, there's a minimal approach to the design, a lot of white space, because there was a desolation in that production, which is three men on a boat dealing with this 25-foot shark.
Right. Wow.
And I just might say my involvement in that movie was quite different from an art director or a production designer, which is the same job, depending if now everybody's a production designer, but I started as an art director. And that fact that the head of the production at Universal said, go make the shark, go find somebody to make it and take it off the lot, that gave me this sort of authority to sort of dictate to some degree a lot of the procedure and the shark and finding the people to do it. So that's sort of unusual for an art director to get that involved in special effects. But because it was away from the studio, my relationship, when I found Bob Matty and Roy Arbogast and got Frank Wormser to do the technical drawings, we had a team, you know, so it became a team thing. And then working with Steven as to what we needed and doing the storyboard. So I was pretty consumed by the whole process of it, not just the sets, you know, which is the sets and the location, is which normally the production designer does it, you know. So it was quite different.
Well, do you think, Joe, that your actions, the way you took control of the special effects and how they were built and presented, do you think that influenced the position, the title of production designer going forward?
Well, that's hard to say because, first of all, production designer, art director is the same thing. Mm-hmm. William Cameron Menzies got production design on what's
Gone with the Wind. Yeah.
What? Gone with the Wind. Okay. Yeah. But very few people got that credit in the 60s and 70s. But it was the same job. You were an art director. And so they started to give that credit more in the 60s and the 70s. But basically, I did the same job as my position on Sugarland Express or all the night galleys. You know, today they would have called me a production designer, but it was the same job. An art director, like for an example, the Star Wars, they had a production designer, and they had about a dozen art directors that did all various things, but they worked under the production designer. But it's sort of complicated, but your question is, would what I had done, would that influence or affect other production designers? I don't think production designers generally get that involved with special effects. You illustrate them, you discuss what it should look like, but the actual technical, physical work is in a different department.
Mm. The sketches, your sketches of the shark and various scenes where the shark is attacking, combined with what we see in the book with actual schematics. We're talking architecturally accurate schematics of things is
right.
Just a delight for me because I love drawing even though I can't draw, and just seeing the impeccable attention to detail for making a mechanical shark. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you could teach classes off some of these drawings, and the specificity with how deep you got into what the shark could do and should do. Were you happy with the shark you ended up with?
Oh, absolutely. Let me just say this. In the book, and Dennis did such a good layout, you have the first big charcoal sketches based on the galley sheets.
Mm-hmm.
Before Stephen was involved or the studio was really involved, it was just David Brown, who was a producer, sent me the galley sheets and said, do some concept drawings, see if we could sell this to the studio, because they didn't have a charge number. I virtually did them for nothing while I was doing a television movie. So those were done without any great detail or research into sharks, the Carcharodon carcharias. When it was a go, then I got with Leonard Capano, who was an ichthyologist at the in San Francisco at the Sternhardt Aquarium, I started making a 4-foot bottle, and he came down from San Francisco and worked with me. So we got the shark to look exactly like a white shark, and so technically, that was one aspect of it, and I think that's pretty well illustrated in the book, the progress, and then getting Bob Matty with Frank Wormser, and Frank was a studio set designer. He was just in the drafted room, and he would just go get a draftsman and give him some work to do. With Frank, he had worked at Lockheed as an engineer, so he was perfect for those technical drawings. And I put him with Bob Matty, so they have put a team. Bob would tell him, we need these rams and we need this and that kind of stuff, and he would illustrate it, technically. So, and you could see in the book the technical drawings, and then you could see a cutaway of the shark and all those, various mechanics in it. So, Dennis, you have anything you want to add on that?
The one thing I will say in defense of the shark, not the shark needs defending, but I do love the fact, and I grew up with this too, people saying, the joke was, the shark doesn't look quite real and stuff like that, okay? And my response is, I don't know, have you ever swum up to a shark's nose? I mean, do you know what it really looks like? I would venture to say that if something like this popped out of the water, I'd jump up on top of the water and run across as fast as I could to get the heck out of there, right? that's the thing. We have a conception, I think, as individuals, of what is real and what isn't real. And it's kind of like in Robert Shaw's speech about, you've got, the black eyes like a doll's eyes, and you think he's not living till he bites you and they roll over white. Okay. I just think, really, technically speaking, the shark is amazing. And if later on we talk about the restoration of that final shark, I've got a fun little story to tell you about how that impacted me just last year.
Let me just say something about the white eye and the black eye. We did build, because they do rotate. When they bite, they go from black and they go to white. And so we had that mechanism in the shark, but when we did it, it looks like a joke. It was like, looks so silly doing that. So we eliminated that. Basically, let me say this: the fact that people say the shark didn't work. Well, going back to it, everybody involved in effects, the studio, Universal said it'd be a year, year and a half. No one's ever done it in the real ocean. And I went to Disney. They would say there would be a year or so, but they wouldn't take it to the ocean. Joe Lombardi, who did The Godfather, big effects guy, he said it would take a year, year and a half, but he was busy. So then I found Bob Matty, and Bob just had this. We'll go for it. Well, basically, we started construction being probably November, late November, early December of 73. The book came out in February 74, and the studio said, because of the successful book, we've got to start shooting in 2 months. So figure that out. Not a year, not a year and a half. Within 4 months, they were expecting the shark. So the guys were working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. We built it in Sunland, in the valley here in L.A., and then shipped them to Martha's Vineyard. They weren't quite finished. And so Bob started testing it, and we had a big problem in that all electronic stuff electricity and saltwater dirt, they don't like each other.
Oh, yes, yes, I see.
And so we would test it, and then that would break down. So basically, Steven had to shoot everything that walk and talk without the shark. Now, another thing I just have to mention, because I get so tired of these critics that seem to know more about it. I mean, they have corrected me at shows. Oh, no, this is the way it was. I said, but, excuse me, I was there. And they said, well, you use the barrels because the shark wasn't working. And I said, no. And if you look at the early sketches based on the book, you'll see the shark and you'll see barrels. So barrels are always planned. It's what they use. And they shoot the harpoon, and then there's a line, and then there's barrels. So I painted the barrels yellow. The idea of having the barrels move around and not the shark was that we didn't want to over-shark it, but it was a Hitchcock thing where you see the barrel pop up and you say, it's there. The shark is there, right? So it was a suspense thing. Yep. So it was, and if you go look at the storyboards at the end of the book, pretty much, every shot, every storyboard with the shark, we got. So it's not that we didn't get it because it didn't work. And one more comment. I think the shark presents a character. I mean, you could do a CGI shark that is so realistic, it's unbelievable. But does it have the character? And I think our shark had a character that people have just gravitated to over all these years.
Absolutely. I violently agree with you.
Yeah, no, I'm nodding my head crazy fast right now. It's a shame you can't see. I do have a question about that, if that's all right. The CGI practical debate that's still happening, you know, which is better, which is worse. I mean, I think you use a combination of the two is a good way to do it. But what are your thoughts on that?
Here's the thing that I would do CGI because you could control it. We set because Dick Zanuck was very concerned that the shark wasn't going to look right or something, but very little confidence in what we were doing. we sent a crew to Australia, Ron and Valerie Taylor, who did Blue Water, White Death, expert shark people, you know. But Valerie told me, she said, Joe, the biggest shark we're going to be able to photograph live would be 16 feet. And our shark was 25 feet. So to get the relative size relationship, I found a small stunt guy, probably 4'6" or something like that. And he said, yeah, he could do scuba and all that stuff. So I made small tanks so they would be relative to the normal tank. I made a small cage so it would be all relative size. And we flew them with a production manager and all that to Australia. And what happened was they put the little guy in the cage, the small cage. The big shark came at it. He got so freaked out. He really wasn't a scuba diver. He sucked all the air out of the tank. That happens a lot in the business. People say, I mean, I had a scene in Jaws 2, and the sequence was swim, Eddie, swim. And then when we got to swim, Eddie, swim, he didn't know how to swim.
Oh, no.
Oh, wow.
But so actors will say that. Oh, yeah, I could ride a bike. I could do all this. And then they can't do it, but then you've already established them. So, in any case, right. He freaked out. He went to the hid in a boat and said, I'm not going to do it. In the meantime, we had another cage, regular size cage, with soft metal, like a breakaway, and the shark decided to go after that. So it got caught in that, and it was just an incredible shot. Okay, the problem was there's no Dreyfus. He was supposed to have eaten Dreyfus prior. In the book, Dreyfus dies. So everybody loved the shot with the shark. So Steven and Zanuck Brown, they said, okay, the Dreyfus character is going to live. he drops this needle he's going to stab the shark with, and he goes down and he hides. So basically, all that changed the script. Now, you asked me, CGI, I would have done all that sequence in CGI.
Oh.
Because I don't think we needed to go and do live sharks. That's really a very laborious kind of thing, waiting for the shark to do the right thing, where you could control it. So we could control the mechanical shark, and we could control the CGI shark, but you can't control a live shark. You know?
Right, I would assume it's also not very healthy for the shark either to keep working them too, right?
Yeah. Or the trainer.
Yeah. Or the trainer.
Well, I am a fan of another shark movie called Deep Blue Sea, and I have to admit that the Jaws shark, Bruce, is a lot more scary than the CGI sharks in Deep Blue Sea, even though they're supposed to be bigger and faster. They aren't as scary as every time I have seen Jaws. And that's I don't know, that's a testament to the suspensefulness of the filmmaking. And I think it was in the early 90s, I got a copy of Jaws on Laserdisc. It was the first time I had seen a high-definition version of it. And I was amazed at the scenes of the orca. You had these great pullback shots of just the flat ocean, the ship, and then you saw shooting stars. You saw one of the meteorite showers going on. I'm like, I've never seen this, and I've watched this movie 100 times. So I am just looking forward to what amazements await on the 4K restoration.
The interesting thing you mentioned, the boat. This is a problem. Without going into long detail, when I scouted for, there was no location scout. There was just me and Stephen. And so I just went and I met Peter Benchley in New York and asked him where he wrote the book, you know, and he had no specific place, Sag Harbor, Covington, Montauk, you know, and blah, blah, blah. So I said, okay. And then he said, but go to Nantucket because my parents live there. It's beautiful. And I said, what about this other island, Martha's Vineyard? He said, no, there's nothing there. He was an island guy. He never went to another island. But anyway, long story short, I went all through New England, scouted these beautiful beaches, but they were covered with snow. Okay. So I eventually got down to Woods Hole, and I took the boat to Nantucket. It got partially there, and the water was so rough, they turned around and said, we're going to have to cancel. So when I got back to Woods Hole, I see, oh, there's a boat to Martha's Vineyard. So I took the boat there. Now, not only was I looking for a beautiful, quaint little thing, like Edgartown, I needed a bay, because there are three mechanical sharks, and the complicated one was on a big barge that you could sink, and then it had a railing, you know, and then it had a big arm lifted up. And the thing is, we needed 25 feet of depth, and we needed a very small tide. Well, we couldn't shoot that on the West Coast because the tides are like 12 feet.
Right,
but
wow.
Here I am in Edgartown, and there is this bay, and it's 25 feet, and it's got a 2-foot tide. And so I was looking not only for the village, I was looking for a place to shoot the shark. All right, long story short, that all worked out fine. I mean, Edgartown was fantastic. Menemsha was perfect for Quint's place. And it had, I mean, it was just all these old fishing shacks, and then it had an empty lot, and I could build Quint's shack there. In any case, that was in December. Come July, August, that bay is just full of boats. And it wasn't in the winter. So Stephen's really strong concept was that I want those guys isolated. I just want to see the boat and nobody around. And that's why he had Shaw break the radio. So there was no communication. Well, it took forever to get a shot without those boats. We'd have to run out and say, would you move the boat? Would you do this? And some people would cooperate and some would be just, you know, stubborn. And so it was really difficult for this young director. The studio was getting very upset. Why isn't he shooting? Well, there's boats out there. Well, just shoot it. We don't. Well, today we could just CGI them out.
Right.
Right?
Wow.
So anyway, a shot like that with just the boat and nothing there was not an easy thing to do.
Which makes it all the more beautiful when you see it, right? That the amount of work it took. And that, I think, comes back to the practical aspect versus the CGI aspect of things. I think we recognize the care and work that goes into this. And that even if the movie's, you know, subpar and some strange thing in it is still going to stick out to us because we're like, somebody built that character. Somebody made that shot, right?
Yeah. I mean, it later when we did Jaws 2, I took all the shark stuff pretty much in Navarre Beach, which is in near Pensacola, and there was just a lot of ocean with no boats, so that changed, made it easier for that.
Oh wow!
But anyway, continue.
Well, I do have a question for Dennis, since he is the architect of this beautiful book. Joe had mentioned including like the sketches and the storyboards. What inspired you to collect all of the schematics, all of the storyboards, all of the legal paper, the handwritten notes that Joe made while making this movie?
And thank you for doing that, by the way.
I'll tell you what, the pleasure was all mine. Because Joe just has an amazing archive. He has kept virtually everything. And as a writer and as someone who works on projects like this, it's a gold mine for me. It makes my job so much easier. It helps me ask questions that I wouldn't normally ask because I don't know what I don't know, right?
Right.
And when I see these things, I have to ask. But for me, and you know, I've studied Jaws for, you know, my whole life as well, ever since I was 12 years old. And I carried the Jaws log around with me in high school religiously, always hoping, you know, always proud to kind of bear that book with me. And yeah, multiple copies of Benchley's book, and then the VHS tape when that came out, the Laserdisc when that popped out, many iterations of DVD and so on. Okay. And we all kind of know what we know about Jaws, or what we think we know about Jaws. And then when I had the opportunity, incredible opportunity, to meet Joe and to start talking about this, and I start to get some recalibration of what I think I know. Okay. And so it's kind of an evolving education, if you will. And so when I saw all the materials that he has, and I was getting more of the details and more of an understanding of how this film was put together, that's all the stuff that I wanted to know. And it's like, okay, I'm probably not the only one who wants to know this. Who else wants to know this? And when I approach a project like this, especially a project like this, it's near and dear to my heart. It's like, what would it be like to be a fly on the wall? And to the very best of my ability, I try to present information that is, in some regards, very esoteric. But it's because I want to see, well, what was it like to be there? And the only person who can really have that experience among us right now is Joe, right? So I'm trying to do the next best thing by just pumping him full all kinds of questions, going, what about this? And what about this? And what about this? You know? And so what's really interesting about the way this all happened, if I can, is that it explained to me the evolution of the film. But what's really interesting to be able to share with other enthusiasts of the film is the evolution of the film from those original galley sheets of the unpublished book that he got, okay, which leads into the concept drawings, which is by the book's narrative, which leads into what you guys will see as the script breakdown notes on Benchley's first cut of the script. Okay. And that's still to the book narrative. That's not to the final film narrative. And we get to watch this narrative progress through the course of this book. And as Joe explains, There's this great footage off Dangerous Reef in Australia. The shark attacks the empty cage. Let's change the script. And all of a sudden, the Hooper character lives, right?
Yeah.
And so we just get to see that whole evolution. And as you look at the book, I tried to intentionally design it to where there were like stories within the story and books within the book. And if you look closely, you're going to see that there's a dimension, I hope, I was able to put into the book that takes you deeper instead of just going left to right. You also get to go top to bottom as well.
Oh, wow, yeah. And I think that's what a testament to something that is so beloved and is so iconic and helps, you know, has helped us in the make the things that we make now, especially in the genre, to have a tome like this to just reference is also mm-hmm. wonderful. To go back and go, well, now how did they do it? And, mm-hmm. you know, feel validated.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was interesting for Dennis is that I've lived in the same house for 50 years. So I have a basement with these big foot lockers, and I would have all the stuff from Jaws, all the illustration. I did all the storyboards because they didn't want to hire an illustrator to do them. Normally, if you do more than a couple drawings, art directors by the union rules should do occasional drawing. They didn't want to pay that low budget, send a guy there. So I did all the storyboards. I did concept sketches. I did notes. I did my breakdowns. And I just, you know, threw it in a footlocker, figuring who would ever need it. In fact, there's a note that's in the book. Mary, who is secretary to the head of the art department, Alice Glitzen, and she would take notes and phone calls and stuff. And so there was a note, she says, meeting in Marshall's office October 3rd at 10 o'clock. That was the meeting that was the presentation to all the studio department heads that were trying to sell the idea of Jaws. I had that little piece of paper. Why I kept that note, I don't know. But it was allowed Dennis to be able to say, October 3rd is when this meeting happened. So he was able, you know, because he does it so well, to put these illustrations based on the gala sheets were presented to everybody on that day. And mm-hmm. that's when the whole thing started. Joe, go find somebody to make the shark.
Right.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a wonderful thing. And for those of you listening, it's on page 62. You're going to see this note. that, you know, I look at this little scrap of paper, I'm like, how do you still have this? and to Joe's mind, he's probably thinking, why do you really care? I'm like, no, this is an artifact. This is incredible stuff. Right.
Right.
So, yeah.
Wow. That's, just, I know some people don't like to dive too deeply into how their favorite movies were made. Some people think it diminishes the magic of the movie. Some people say, it's like, well, if I see how they did this, I'll notice it next time I watch the movie. But I'm the opposite. I want to know how that magic was made because it gives me a greater appreciation of it when I see it on screen. It doesn't detract from that shark swimming by the boat and Brody saying, you're going to need a bigger boat.
You know, let me tell you that the shot, that was the first shot we got the shark, left to right mm-hmm. shark working. And we did tests, and Verna Fields, who is the editor, she had a big Kim that was her cutting machine. She won the Academy Award for editing, and she was like, everybody loved her. I mean, she did work for Coppola, for a number of right, George Lucas, what have you. Anyway, I'm there, and Ron and Valerie are on the phone. In fact, that's in the book, too, our conversation about the shark. And Valerie's saying, yeah, Joe, you don't have to move it too much, because as they approach something, they sort of glide with it. And so mm-hmm. if you see that shot, the high shot with the shark going by the boat, it's just sort of gliding by. It's not trying to bite the boat. It's just sort of like, this is me. Look at me. I'm so big, you know. And it'll come later. I'll be, you know, right. knocking your boat down. So I just think they helped us because they knew the shark so well. How so today, maybe, you know, they would have the shark splashing and charging up, but they don't. They survey their prey first.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And if I can, let me just follow on that point there, because again, this whole myth about the sharks not working. Well, what's fun about that, and you'll see that transcript in the book, what Joe's talking about, the test footage, they're basically telling him, hey, you know what? Your shark moves too much. Your shark can do too many things. Real sharks don't do all that. And when I got that revelation, that's an epiphany. I'm going, what do you mean the shark's not working? I think actually the shark is putting in some overtime right now.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that. I had a question that I was dying to ask about how the fact that like modern horror owes so much to Jaws, because we use it in conversation about how we're going to do a particular thing. We say, well, it's like Jaws. You don't show too much of the monster. You show just mm-hmm. enough. And then if you want to do a big reveal, you can. And we always operated under the idea that that was to cover for the fact that Bruce wasn't working. But to hear you say, no, that was the intention. It's a Hitchcock thing is even more enlightening, because that was deliberate. And that I think that solidifies what we were talking about, how that's just good suspense. It's just how you make a good, scary movie.
Let me explain something about the shark not working. It wasn't helped by the producers and other people. When we were over budget and over schedule by quite a bit, probably supposed to be $4.5 million, I think it went $7.5 million or $8 million, and we got back to the studio, we were not heroes. The studio were not happy with us. They took the shark and threw it in the back lot and let it rot. They sold the orca to somebody, and then when the picture came out, then the studio said, "Oh, we need that orca back again. Oh, we got to make a shark we could hang, you know." So they made a shark, which you'll see at the end of the book, and Dennis will talk about it, out of the original mold. But people were saying, "Oh, well, you know, the reason we're overscheduled because the shark didn't work." The shark. So that got out. A lot of it was blaming it on the shark and not the other part of the production. And so the news media picked up on that. You know what I mean? I mean, Stephen had said some stuff about Bob Matty that he later apologized for and wrote a nice letter and said, you know, I was at the time stressed out and I mentioned, you know, some negative things, but he retracted that stuff. So anyway, that grew from the very beginning. And one more thing. When the shark worked before John Williams' wonderful music, mm-hmm. when it came out and it opens its mouth and closes its mouth, and shark, those valves and rams made a lot of noise, like, you know. And so that's exactly what happened. After, when Steven said, cut, everybody would laugh at the shark. The crew would laugh. So the first screening in L.A., I was there with Steven and all the executives, and I'm thinking, oh, God, they're going to laugh. You know, through all the walk and talk, and I'm thinking, they're going to laugh when it comes out, you know, at Scheider. And they didn't laugh. They screamed. And I thought, oh, I guess it works, you know. and then the studio executives went off into a men's room, and they reorganized the whole distribution. Before, you would open in a couple theaters for a few weeks and see how it grew. They opened in 450 theaters. Today they do 4,000, but that was the biggest ever, and that became the biggest summer release movie, because they never released movies. They released him for the Academy Award. They promoted those, you know, so October, November for when we were voting. But a summer, you know, that was before Star Wars and all those. So the idea that they didn't laugh, they were screaming, is what I was worried about. Now, one other thing. A couple years ago, in Catalina Island. There's a museum there. And they had a wonderful display of Jaws stuff for 6 months. There was illustrations, my illustration, Frank Wormser's. Greg Nicotero made the three characters unbelievable because that's what his company does. And we had the original Cage and all that. And Dennis did a book, a Jaws book, the first Jaws book for that show. And they were selling it. And now we have the one that Titan bought and more elaborate. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it was the evening. And so they were going to show the Jaws on the big screen. And I thought, okay, well, I did the introduction with the woman that runs the museum there. And I thought, okay, I'm going to leave. I don't have to see Jaws again. And she said, and then Joe's going to talk about Jaws after the screening. So my wife said, oh, I got a seat. So she had a seat for me and for Dennis. And we sat there, and it's the first time I'd seen it in a long time on a big screen, years and years. And it had been so long, you know, that I was not concerned about if the shark worked or anything I did. I was just watching the movie. And I got to tell you, I was so impressed with the three actors on the boat and what Stephen did, that relationship between the old crusty fisherman and the smart-ass ichthyologist kid and the cop that didn't want to be there. And that was the movie to me. And when they were doing the scar scene and all that, and I went to Stephen and I said, God, that was such a great scene. You know, I said, what we need to do is bring the shark in that same area, which we did later. That's another story. But when the movie was done, I realized this is really a good movie because I was so concerned watching it before, whether it looked real, whether it worked, whether this, you know, all the stuff that I was involved in. And just to see it and see the relationship. It's not just a shark movie. It's three guys with their own problems, you know?
You know, it's interesting you say all that, Joe, because we sat there and, you know, Summer and Jaws, every now and then I get these moments where I realize, you know, pinch me, am I really here, you know?
Right.
And I'm sitting there next to Joe watching Jaws. I'm going, wow, okay, 12-year-old me would have never conceived this, but here we go. And so we watch the film, and I'm always captivated by it. But he turns to me at the end of the film as the credits start to roll, and exactly what you said, Joe, you turned to me and you said, you know, that's a really good movie. And I'm like, well, yeah. It was so fun. Well, it was so genuine.
When you get involved, for an example, Dennis also did a book the year before, the same, God, what's her name, Julie, who runs the museum. She had a show, a display for Close Encounters. And Dennis wrote a book, and Wyoming that year flew me up to Devil's Tower, their tourist vacation thing, where to go for, you know, a tourist guide, their park commission, and they have Yellowstone, whatever. So they wanted me to go and do the same thing I did 40 years before, scouting Devil's Tower. And I had shots of me scouting Devil's Tower, and they did exactly the same thing, walking around Devil's Tower. And so they did this film to promote the park system. Well, I had shots, just my own shots, personal shots of Steven and Vilmos Zsigmond, the cameraman, and they wanted to use them, and Sony said, you can't use them. Well, Sony was not the company when we did Close Encounters. It was Columbia, but then they bought Columbia. So they were, like, very difficult. And so Dennis and I, we self-published it, and it was a beautiful little book, but it was, you know, we had to sell it on our own. Where by contrast,
kind of like a little hidden jewel.
Yeah, but contrast, Universal has been extremely cooperative on this book. But that's just the way it goes.
Yeah. Oh, so much film history for so much just lovely, lovely memories. And I'm so glad that Jaws, I didn't know that there was a 4K version coming out for the 45th anniversary until I talked with Dennis a couple days ago. I'm like, oh, really? Let me, I'm going to have to.
I just got through spending a lot of money during this lockdown period. Thank you for,
well,
gotta go back online.
I'll do Universal a favor and say it releases on June 2nd, mm-hmm. right? And I've got my own pre-order already, so there you go.
we're only human. There's only so much we can take.
I'd like to point something out. This is sort of interesting. So the studio didn't care about this Jaws movie until it came out. And then the Universal Tours, you know, their park thing, they realized we don't have anything from this movie, and it's the biggest movie now from Universal. So someone, they said, well, we could make a fiberglass shark based with the original mold, you know, so it would have every detail like the real shark. So they made this, and they hung it up by its tail, and people took pictures. In fact, there's a picture of Greg Nicotero, who was 16 then, took a picture. He was standing by the shark. Okay, so that went the way, and then they had to buy the boat back and all that. So that was there for a number of years, and then they made the shark ride, which really upset me because they had the teeth look like big bananas because they thought, oh, it's got to be really mean look. They're just really stupid looking. And so somebody got the shark, the plastic, the fiberglass shark, and it was not a car dealer, but it was a part, blocks and blocks and blocks of cars, and you go there, and you pay to get in, and then you could find parts to your car that you take off of what's there. Anyway, he hung the shark on a pole, and it sat there for years, and they had bad teeth. They had just sort of jigsaw wood teeth. So I got a call from Corey Turner from NPR about 9 years ago, and he's asked about this shark. Is it really made from the same mold and blah, blah, blah? And I said, he was flying out from New York. I said, fine, and I'll get Roy Abergask, who made the actual skin and the mold. So we went there, and he covered that for NPR or whatever, and Roy said, yeah, it was exactly same shark. It's the only real representative of the real shark. So, okay, fine. A couple years after that, I got a call from a woman from the museum, the new Motion Picture Academy Museum that they were going to build. And she was talking that we'd like to buy that and have it redone. So I got Roy and I got Greg Nicotero, who I've known for quite a few years because he's a big Jaws fan, and I gave him copies of all my stuff. And he has a big company, and he does The Walking Dead, and does all these characters and monsters. And he had built a shark for the 30th anniversary, and so he was really into it. So I got him, and the idea was to restore it. And perfect, you know, it's the same silica sand, 46, so the paint was like a sandpaper so the water would not dribble off. So that's in the back of the book, if you look at it, and it's the new restoration of the original, from the original mold, and that's going to go into the, I went to the museum to see where they're going to hang it, and they say they would hang it, you know, with the tail up or tail down. I said, well, you want to sort of, you know, biting up. So anyway, they're still working on that. I don't know when they're going to get that done. But it's interesting to see it. It's the back of the book. Dennis is there and Greg and what have you. But yeah. So that's the legacy lives on.
Wow.
And in fact, we just got an email yesterday or day before from the Academy Museum wanting some ideas from production designers and they went.
Nice.
Good. And wow. I will say this, I want to jump in because he did mention this, and it's just, again, this for me, I'm lucky. The experience continues. So yeah, we get to go down and see this shark. Okay. And I know the shark is big, and I've seen Greg's just the head itself. Okay, and I've been up to that, and like, wow, you know, it's got a deep throat, Frank. You know, but it's a big, big head. I'm like, okay, it's big. So we actually go in to get to see this actual full bodied shark over at Nicotero's place. And I walk in, I'm like, yeah, that's big. And then I walk up to the dorsals, and I'm like, wow, I could like, no, not the dorsals, but the pectorals. I thought, wow, I could lay on those pectorals. That's big. And then you walk past his belly, and the belly is just humongous. And then I walk past the tail, and the tail is 6 foot, tip to tip, right? And as I'm walking down, I'm realizing how large this thing is. And even in photos, it kind of underplays how large this thing really is until you see it in person. And I'm just kind of putting off this little stream of expletives as I continue to walk down the path in amazement. Yeah. And at that point, and I've said this before, I told Joe, I said, my gosh, you made this thing move. That's amazing.
Let me just say something about the size. Stephen and I had decided 25-foot shark. I don't know why, because the biggest shark, white shark, they've ever caught, I think, was 20 feet, or they found remnants of a 20-foot shark. And we said we needed a little bit bigger than that, you know, but not. So what we did, and the studio executives, they wanted to know how big this thing was or how big it should be, because anyway, so I had this set designer in the art department, John Tatu-Lorenzo. He drew a 20-foot shark, just an outline on, you know, big paper, and he drew a 30-foot shark. So we put that down in the parking lot, Universal. And they had 20-foot on one side and 30-foot on the other side. So we got all the executives down there. Steve and I were sitting there. And then they said, well, the 20 doesn't look that big, but the 30 looks too big. It's like a monster. And so Steven and I said, how about something in between, like 25 feet? Yeah, that sounds good. Okay. So that was our little trick.
Nice. So nice.
I mean, these are stories, but they're real, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's how they happened. And and Martha's Vineyard was a very difficult thing because I loved it. Stephen loved it. Of all the places it had, we went to look at another place that some of his friends recommended. But this had the water area. It had Edgartown. It had Menemsha and all this stuff. But Dick Zanuck was concerned about Chappaquiddick and the Kennedy thing when that lady died on Chappaquiddick.
Right.
The big political thing there. And also, he said, there's an awful lot of rich people that vacation in Martha's Vineyard. I mean, it's, well, you know, presidents go there. It was a place to go for, you know. Anyway, so Stephen was very smart. He got the various selectmen. There's like seven different provinces there. And he got those selectmen and he put them in the movie. So they were pretty excited about that. And the Kelly House and all these things, they were pretty quiet until the summer. So we were going to be there, you know, like April, May, June. So they were happy. Oh, they're going to be able to fill the rooms early. And other than the rich people, there are a lot of people that needed work. So I took a painter and a carpenter, same guys I used at Sugar Land Express, Ward Welton, Jimmy Woods, and we hired locals to build the boat and to build Quinn Shack. So they were really happy that they were making money like crazy, building this stuff for the, we built two boats, one that would sink and Bob had it rigged, and we redid the, we bought a boat, but we had to totally rebuild it. So that made the island happy. It got a little difficult in the summer when all the tourists were coming, you know, but then of course we hired a lot of them for extras, for the beach and stuff like that. So, that's you know, nothing's easy. It just happens. You know.
Jeez, yeah.
Awesome. Well, this has been a delight for me, and I'm sure for Josh as well.
I'm still vibrating with excitement. Thank you so much for answering my questions.
Joe Alves, Dennis Prince, the current protectors of our memories of Jaws. Thank you so much for being here.
Okay, well, it's our pleasure.
Thank you for having us. Absolutely.
Yeah. And don't forget to tell people to buy the book.
Oh, definitely, definitely. The book is Designing Jaws.
Designing Jaws.
It is available now. It is available
on Amazon.
Yep, Amazon, any bookstore.
Amazon is a pretty good price, too. It's actually cheaper than what we were selling the other one for. Because Titan owns it, so we don't really have control over that. They bought the book rights and stuff, and they really, really helped. And Dennis laid out a bigger book, and so yeah, you get it for a pretty good price.
Yeah,
people... it's a gorgeous book too. Yeah. I wanted to say that, like, my copy's on its way, but there's photos on Amazon that you can just kind of flip through, and Summer sent it my way. And it's normally with coffee table books, you get this, you know, some cool pictures from the back behind the scenes. This feels like you found a journal, like an like the original stuff. So it's just fascinating and gorgeous.
Yeah, there's stuff in there that I didn't think we were going to put in, like all my breakdown of the sets. I said, why do you want to put that in? Well, it's interesting. Jaws fanatics, sort of. Oh, this is how it broke down, you know. But I was a little embarrassed by it, but whatever.
No,
Dennis had to
stuff.
Correct my spelling. It wasn't what I liked.
You were fine. It's all good.
Yeah, and I, for one... I'm a fan of Titan's work, so I'm glad they got a hold of it. I mean, they did a beautiful, beautiful book a few years back about the Avengers TV series.
Oh, yes.
And it was lovely. They have some excellent, beautiful period shots. You know, you've got Steed and Peele there, and they're just a lovely book. And many books over the years, so I'm a fan of Titan's work, and I'm glad they did as good a job with Jaws as they've done with the others.
They did a good job. It was a nice presentation.
Yes, and we will have links to where people can buy the 4K Jaws and Designing Jaws, but we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
The lonely alien pet bravely waits for the family that may never return. An astronaut with seconds to live discovers just how good victory can taste. A mecha pilot and an aristocrat strike up an unlikely friendship. Take a ride with Escape Pod, the Hugo-nominated weekly science fiction podcast, at escapepod.org. Every week we'll launch you into an alternate reality, so buckle up, it's story time.
And oh my God, was that just the best discussion chat?
Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. I just have to get it out. I'm sorry, because like you try, you know, you have to keep yourself together when you're talking to people that are just people that you just grew up wanting to meet. And like, I know that I was just sitting in the back, like trying to put on my best, like NPR voice, like, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Oh, fabulous. Oh, yeah. I can see how that's hilarious. And I hate that I couldn't, that we weren't like hanging around a fire pit. So I could be like, Joe, oh my God. So I got a question about this. So I just have to get the childlike energy out now because I've been cloistering it for,
I fully understand. There have been more than a handful of interviews that I have done. Slice of Sci-Fi has been around for 15 years. You believe that?
No, I don't.
This year is 15 years.
That's
probably
awesome.
One of the oldest podcasts out there. And over the years, yes, I have had to internally Hog Tie, my inner fangirl.
Yeah.
I had a chance to interview Matt Frewer a few years back.
Oh, wow,
and
really?
I told him before we started, I said, "Sir, I'm going to just fangirl for a moment, because if I don't, I'm probably just going to start babbling in the middle of our..." And he thought that was the funniest thing ever. And because, like I said, Max Headroom,
Max Headroom, man, is
glorious. He also had a role in a 20-hour-long miniseries on Sci-Fi Channel called Taken, which is...
I don't know that one.
A lot of people have not seen it. And I just got
lucky...
Well,
now that I know that Matt Frewer is involved,
I got lucky enough to grab a copy of it on DVD. It's a big box set. Who else is in it?
Wow.
Anton, the girl.
Taken, you said?
It's called Taken. It's about alien abduction affecting three generations of three different families, and they're all connected.
Wait a minute.
Dakota Fanning's first thing. She was like six, maybe? I don't know.
This is like flashing major. What year was that? 2000 and what? Oh no, we're both gonna Google
2006?
Later. We'll Google later. Something about that struck me when you said the generational thing. I'm like, I seem to recall seeing Matt Frewer's face in something relating to this.
And
oh,
Heather,
wow.
the woman who was the lead in Blair Witch Project, she's in it.
Wow. Okay, I just Googled it. Yes, I do remember this show. Crazy.
It's crazy that Sci-Fi Channel hasn't replayed it yet. But anyway, Matt Frewer, fangirl moment. This is a fangirl moment. And I have a little story to tell that ties into Jaws.
Oh, also, just because we're talking about this, Steven Spielberg presents Taken.
Yep.
So
that's
to bring us home.
Yeah, that's the Spielberg connection.
Yeah,
but
I remember this.
There was a movie that was in production, a horror movie called Tar, about a creature that comes out of the La Brea tar pits. The producer, director, I think he also wrote it, or maybe he and a friend wrote it.
Okay.
Aaron Wolf is his name. The movie has not been released yet, to my knowledge, but he did a documentary called Restoring Tomorrow about the restoration of, there's a iconic historic synagogue in LA.
In Los Angeles. Yes, yeah. Yes, yes. I know this movie. Yes.
Yes. Well, Aaron was telling me that one of the guys, he's friends with Timothy Bottoms, who is in Tar. And we were just talking after one of a couple different interviews, and he was saying, yeah, Timothy was supposed to be in Jaws. And I'm like,
what?
Really? And I'm like, really? He says, yeah, he was originally cast as Hooper. And back in the day, Timothy Bottoms was, you know, 6 foot tall, blonde haired, sun-kissed surfer dude. And Aaron was saying he didn't understand why Timothy was cast as Hooper originally, but then replaced with Richard Dreyfuss. Now, I hadn't read the book Jaws until 2 or 3 years after I saw the movie. I didn't even know there was a book when I was 10 years old. You know, later on,
Totally.
When I'm looking for, you know, book for Star Wars, I say, what, Jaws has a book too? Wait, how did... So I got Jaws and read it a couple times. And I told Aaron, I'm like, you've never read the book Jaws, have you? And he said, no. I'm like, in the book, Hooper is a surfer dude, 6 foot tall, blonde haired surfer looking guy. And Aaron goes, what? Wait, really? And I'm like, yeah. And in the book, he dies. And then I said, bonus, in the book, he has an affair with Brody's wife. And he's just like, what? So he said he was going to go back and talk to Timothy after.
Wow.
And just ask him. He said, did you know all this? So there's a Jaws connection there. He had no idea about, and we were sitting there listening to Joe talk about the changes in the script based on, you know, what was available
that
to shoot.
Blew my mind.
Yeah.
That's crazy. That whole thing about the shot they got of the shark dictating whether or not Dreyfuss is going to live or not because they wanted to use it.
Mm-hmm.
That makes that scene even crazier to me that's a real shark.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, yes, when you see the movie, you know, it it's a real shark sure, but like that it wasn't shot for the film.
Well, the fact that that wasn't shot for the movie, that that was shot for as a test to see, you know, for scale of size.
Right.
And there's like, well, we have to use it because technical.
Because it's badass.
You know, so for technical reasons, we'll lose it. It's like, yeah, well, yeah, Hooper can live. What the hell, you know? And I thought they just rewrote it that Hooper lived because Dreyfus was an up-and-comer. You
right,
know?
That's what I figured too. Right?
And I'm like, no, they let him live because of technical difficulties, because the shark
right.
would not behave itself. That is so funny.
That's crazy. Oh, just sidebar, Timothy Bottoms instead made it in 1975, made a movie called Operation Daybreak, which is a little World War Nazi security system Czech commando assassination movie. Just in case you're curious.
That's hilarious. Hilarious.
I was freaking out hardcore, and I hope I didn't come off that way when Joe was talking about the, because I came in, backstory, I came in with like three questions from friends, because I was like, hey guys, so I may or may not be talking to somebody who may or may not be working on Jaws or have worked on Jaws. What questions would you ask? And they were, everybody immediately was like, well, would horror be different if the shark was better?
You mean
because of if the shark was better, like what they, not better, what they wanted the shark to be.
Right? And because it's like the story all these years has been, you didn't see as much of the shark in the beginning
right.
because it didn't work. And now we find out, like, nah, we were doing a Hitchcock thing.
No, we did that on purpose. And I'm like, that makes it infinitely cooler.
Uh-huh.
And that the fact that the shark actually did work, and it worked exactly like it was supposed to, it's just that they had never tested it. I was like, oh, man, like, we were raised to think that Jaws was like
an accidental hit.
An awesome accident.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, no, it was a meticulously made... a deliberate movie, and that's just.
And
okay,
they just.
Sorry,
they
I was
just,
like, it was so hard for me not to go, get out of here when he said that.
And the fact that it was meticulous, and that they pulled off some epic in production adjustments. It was like something went wrong. Okay, let's pivot. Something else went wrong. Okay, we can work around this. We can switch that up.
Right. Like, sounded like it was going fine the way he was talking about
mm-hmm.
it. It's like, oh, yeah, something went down, so we just figured, all right, let's move production here. That whole thing about the ships not being in the way so they could get that one awesome shot makes that shot. I was like, yeah, put obviously, you know, it's in the film archives, but I'm like, put that up on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't worry about the shark. Get that shot of the orca alone in the ocean.
Yeah, and that one
that
shot.
Was a human feat. Right?
That one shot. The first time, like, and I was saying, the first time I saw that on Laserdisc and I noticed the meteorite shower behind it, I'm like, holy, what the hell? That's been there
right.
the whole time. So I can't
and
wait.
That's such a Spielberg thing too, mm-hmm. to have the stars and like a little a shooting star in the back. That's like straight up his whole look, right?
Pretty. I should actually try to figure out when that was shot to know which meteor showers they were. Was it the August one? Was it the April ones?
Wow. Yeah. I'm sure you know. I mean, you might have access to a guy who might know the answer to the
mm-hmm.
just like
yes, yeah. Could you know, email him and say, "Yo,
email
dude."
Him. Just sidebar. Forgot to ask.
Yeah, just. But
so,
yeah, that's
so
just did, the, everything about this movie.
Yeah.
Is still iconic. It's still.
I have friends who've never seen it. I'm so excited to introduce that because I told them we like a couple of people like, hey,
wait,
Zoom party, let's watch Jaws because this Blu-ray's coming out.
Wait, you have friends who've never seen Jaws?
Here's the thing. Okay, yes, and I am aware of the fact that I said I have friends that have never seen Jaws. I understand that if you are not a horror person, if you're not a movie person, this might miss you. You are aware of Jaws, but why see it? Because you know what it is. It's a shark movie with the da-da-da-da. Yeah, I know what Jaws is. But if you're not like a movie person or a horror person, would you ever really even bother watching it? Or like,
Okay.
Then I started thinking, like, have you never been to a sleepover where you watched it? Like, who were these friends of yours
and
that
I have
never introduced you to it?
I have to ask, how can you justify you being a fan of movies? You've seen Godfather, but you have not seen Jaws? Excuse me, what?
Exactly. Exactly. So I think that, like, while I can understand how it could not happen to a person because you're not into these things, what I can't understand is why you never sought it out. And if that is because I don't like horror, I get it. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I am so excited to have this moment with my friend because I'm like, I get to watch you watch Jaws for the first time. And I'm not going to say a word, but, you know, like, no spoilers, obviously. I mean, and obviously they wouldn't have looked up those spoilers anyway because they didn't care. So I get to see them watch Robert Shaw deliver that monologue drunk in the boat,
mm-hmm.
At like for the first time. And I get to see what them laugh at the jokes, like Roy Scheider's bigger boat joke. Like they'll get to experience that. So I am selfishly very excited for this.
There's a note. Them. There's a note in this book that says that line was ad-libbed. I'm like, I did not know that.
Oh, the stories about Robert Shaw on set and like what that was like working with him are worth their weight in gold.
No, the bigger boat line was ad-libbed.
Oh, no, I know. I'm saying like this movie has a plethora of awesome stories mm-hmm. about what those three guys were up to.
Okay, I have a question. Have you ever used a Quint quote in real life?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, whenever... like the doll's eyes conversation is
goodness.
My go-to whenever we're doing impressions of drunk friends. I'm like, you know, he's just in the corner going, he's like a doll's eyes. He's looking right through you. I'm like, it is in the nomenclature.
How come that's always involving drunk friends? Because in college, you know, you have friends who are drunk who are about to embark on a alcohol-inspired, foolhardy adventure. And my job was to just sit there and listen to their plan. And I would just shake my head and go, farewell and adieu to you, fair Spanish ladies. Farewell and adieu to you, ladies of Spain.
Outstanding. Outstanding.
Because that's the line. It's like you go in the cage. Cage goes in the water. Shark's in the water. Farewell and adieu. And he just starts singing. See ya.
Yeah. Have a good... What's crazy about Quint's character is that you do see it coming if you're smarter enough about like what reality is when it comes to storytelling. But if you're just a dumb kid like me, when I saw it the first time, I'm like, that guy's going to save him. Like, they got to listen to that crazy guy because he's seen stuff. But as I get older, I watch it. I'm like, no, don't listen to that crazy guy. He's drunk. Don't let him touch that thing. Are you insane? Like that movie, the characters, that trio. And I did love what it was Dennis saying. Wait, was it Dennis or was it Joe that was saying that? Like
it was
that
Joe.
It was Joe,
like
right?
The three of them.
Joe
were...
said that that's the core of the movie. And I had just had this conversation with my friend last night about how excited I was that I was going to get to meet Joe Alves and talk to Dennis about his book and all that kind of cool stuff. But we had talked about how, as much as everyone loves the Jaws and talks about, oh, it's the shark movie, I never think of it like that. I always think about it like, oh, no, it's that adventure movie about those three dudes that drive into the heart of darkness and get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
It's never shark forward, right?
No, it's about the people, the relationships they have. And if you think of it, if Hooper had died, Brody would have been our first final girl.
That's a good call. Man, so many firsts this movie. Like, it kicked off the horror genre for decades after that, for a decade, right? Like,
it was the first one that came out that everybody paid attention to. It was the first one that came out that made 2 years worth of beachgoers say, I'm not going in the water.
You can't yell shark in a swimming pool because of Jaws.
Oh,
that's still a thing you can't do even now.
Really?
Like, if you're just like, shark, you watch people turn around. You're like, what are you doing?
You know, there's no way that a shark is going to be in this pool, but still, people freak out. That's funny.
Yeah, man.
I had no idea. I had no idea.
It's one of, yeah, the movie, and I love that that the and it's also kind of really it's actually more of a shame, but I do love the power of movies. That we have such a new concept of sharks where we actually have to have specials and documentaries be like, no, sharks aren't like that. The reason you think sharks are like that is because of Jaws. That is why. Mm-hmm. Not Shark because of history.
Discovery Channel made its mark. It became a channel that people had to watch because of Shark Week.
Shark Week! And I still watch Shark Week.
Yes.
But they had to do it to get, because obviously when they started off doing Shark Week, it was like, oh man, people love sharks. Let's do crazy shark attacks. And then they started to become the Discovery Channel again and go, oh wait, we're science-based. We're discovery-based. Let's show what sharks are really like and do that as a way of a form of activism to say, hey, the only reason you're afraid of sharks is because of a movie.
Mm-hmm. Like generations
of that.
Mm-hmm. And you have that one shot that everybody saw in, Planet Earth, the first Planet Earth. The sharks feeding off the seals around the South Africa.
Right.
And you see that one shark go airborne with a seal in its mouth, and you're like, oh!
They're incredible creatures. And we now know that, you know, my generation, your generation, because of these Discovery Channel things. But before that,
Jaws
is what set off for, 30, 45 years of this delusion that we have that sharks are these crazy, dangerous creatures. And it's like, no, they're not. They're as dangerous as any wild animal would be,
mm-hmm.
but they're actually like, they're like dogs of the ocean. They're some of them are very friendly. And the only time that you're likely to be attacked by them is if you screw around in places that you're not supposed to, mm-hmm. which I love that movie had the foresight to have as part of its makeup.
I think
it was never the sharks are horrible monsters. No, like the movie doesn't even say that.
Yeah. Cause like in the, I think Dreyfus's character Hooper said, you know, this shark is rare for these waters at this time of year. And I think it was, some later, it might've been one of the Shark Week specials. They were saying that the breeds of shark most likely to eat humans are great whites and tigers, and they are only doing it, they're taking a bite out of them because in the water, in certain situations, on boogie boards, on surfboards, in small inflatable boats, we look like the food they normally eat.
Right. And it only really happens if we invade the area that we're not, that is their territory. And we were in Roatan, which is a dive area near Cuba. And while we were out there, they're very famous for the shelf. It's like a 1,000-foot shelf around the island. So if you are a diver and you're like a professional diver, you go to Roatan because it's like spectacular. And while we were there, I'm not a professional diver. I went there because it sounded cool and we were snorkeling. But while we were there, there's a lot of sharks. And I was like, well, why is that safe? And the guy's like, it's very safe. This is why people get attacked, is because they go to areas where the sharks are feeding during the time that they feed. And that feeding frenzy area, like fisher people are doing that. They're deliberately putting the sharks there so that they don't mistakenly attack other people. And then people kind of swim into that area, which is kind of what Jaws is about.
Mm.
Which I'm like, yeah, because this is a big shark that's hungry. And then maybe, I know it's Lovecraftian because, you know, why is it here? I don't know. Climate change, go on. But it's still just doing its thing. And you mess with it. Right. They open the beaches too soon. So it still has that foresight that, like, we're still the problem. And I love that. Oh, I love that. I think that's so cool.
We're keeping the beaches open. The shark's going, ooh, a buffet.
A buffet. That looks delicious. What does the shark know? And speaking of what, you know, classic good visceral horror can bring, we're still using Jaws as metaphors for COVID right now. People are still throwing that meme
out
there, right?
All of the memes about the mayor.
Right.
Saying, it's safe, go in the water.
How brilliant is that character that they made him, like, and how much have we viewed him differently? Like, because you kind of sympathize with him a little bit, where you're like, yeah, I mean, you got to open the beach, he's got to make the money. But, giant killer shark.
People gonna die.
Right. And yeah, I could talk about Jaws for conceivably 46 hours.
Forever, forever, forever. Oh my goodness.
But it was so cool to have the concept of that movie validated for me even harder talking to Joe and hearing, oh yeah, everyone seems to think that it was this all that we, the shark was a big problem and it was such a nightmare. He's like, no, it was funny because it's a big goofy shark, but when you see it on screen, it's terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And then to hear him say that we were deliberately treading that course of what to show and what not to show. I don't know. I think it elevates the movie for me even more.
Yeah.
To know that that was there, that they really were playing with some really great algorithms of suspense and stuff like that.
Yeah. And it says a lot that for me, the only shark movie that has come close to being entertaining and scary is Deep Blue Sea, because all the others are just silly. But Deep
it's
Blue
goofy.
Sea. Yeah. Deep Blue Sea tapped into a little bit of the we're stuck underwater fear that the abyss touches into.
Right.
And then you have the genetically engineered sharks that are smarter than they should be. But they're CGI.
Yeah,
they're CGI. So they aren't, there's not that, there's something missing from
that tactile something
yeah.
that the human eye can
yeah,
see.
Because there's
right?
this one scene in Deep Blue Sea where it's swimming down one of the hallways. And that scene should be scarier, and it's not.
Right. No. And that's what I want. I wish we'd had even more time with Joe to really dive into the technicality and like be like, so like, how do you really feel about CGI? Because his answer is it's easier and cheaper. And I'm like, yeah, but from an artist's perspective, what do you think about it? And I really wish we could have dove into that a little bit more. Because I feel like
it depends on the CGI, because CGI, I have talked to a lot of indie horror makers, even last year, and all of the ones where the story, the reactions, the incidents in the films that were the most affecting were done with practical effects. And I asked them, like, this scene here, this was practical or CG? And 90% of them, they were practical.
Mm-hmm.
And they used CG to clean up the edges or something, but the effect itself, the core of the effect, was practical. And you look at CG, it is necessary in a lot of places. I mean, so many of the science fiction movies that we love could not exist without.
And I'm not saying it doesn't have its place. Obviously, mm-hmm. like Lord of the Rings does it really well. Jurassic Park still holds up, and like, but when and like Mad Max Fury Road wouldn't exist
mm-hmm.
If they weren't able to paint out the cables in that movie. So totally hear that. I just think it's when it's used. Yeah, no, you're going.
When
sorry.
It's, yeah, when it's overused in horror is where I get sad.
That is why, and I hope this isn't too controversial for the listeners, that is why I was only mildly impressed with A Quiet Place. Because I was like, most of this is great, and then you get CGI monsters. And I was like, eh. I know that thing's not there, though. It just looks like a crazy wiggly octopus ear monster alien. I was like, if you'd have done the whole movie and barely ever saw them, I thought that movie would have been fantastic. And instead, when you see it, it just takes me out every time. And I was like, eh, so much about it is good, though.
Believe it or not, that's kind of the reason I haven't been in a rush to see Bird Box.
I have a couple of reasons why you shouldn't be in a rush to see Bird Box. You can check out my podcast, Chad the Podcast Man.
So Chad the Bird has opinions on Bird Box is
so
what you're
Chad
saying.
Chad the Bird at the beginning of what was that, 2019 was when Bird Box came out.
Mm-hmm.
It was the last movie. It was 2018 when it came out because it was the end of the year. And Chad, oh God, what year is it? Anyway, it was at the end of one of the years that was only 3 years ago that now feels like 20. And at the end of the year for the last Machete we did of that year, they wanted Chad to watch Bird Box, and his whole rant is about how I just wasted the opportunity to watch all of these other movies, but no, you wanted to talk about Bird Box. And then I just spoil Bird Box from beginning to end. I'm like, here's how stupid this stupid movie was.
Oh my.
And it makes me even angrier having read the book at how much cooler that movie could have been.
Now,
so
Josh Mallerman, the sequel is coming out. It's called Mallory.
Oh, interesting.
The book. The book sequel.
I'm interested in the world. You know, I would love to know more about this.
Oh, where? Okay, you're going to make me check my emails now, aren't you? Mr. Mallerman. Yes, the sequel to Bird Box is called Mallory, and street date is July 21. So keep your eyes out on Random House.
Yeah, and check out the first book too, because it is very good. The Netflix movie, you can decide for yourself what you think.
Cool. Yeah, they sent me an email last week saying I can read an advanced copy of it right now if I want.
Wow. Oh, and you are, aren't you?
It's on my list. I have a stack of, 4 movie reviews and 8 book reviews to get to finish, including one movie came out this week, Vast of Night. It's an Amazon original.
I was just about to ask you about that. I didn't know. Is
God,
it good? Did you see it?
It is amazing. I watched it last night.
Yes.
I'm
so excited.
It is
good. Good, good, good. I may watch that tonight because it just dropped.
It did. It's on Amazon Prime, and it is so worth seeing.
Ooh, that makes me very happy because I had seen a... one of those podcast ads for it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I heard one of those podcast apps for it. And I was like, this sounds like another Stranger Things kind of vibe.
Mm-mm.
But then I keep reading the reviews and they're like, no, it's really good.
Nope. It's like,
not that I didn't like Stranger Things. I'm just
let's say it's not Stranger Things. It has a Pleasantville kind of vibe.
Mm.
It's all 1950s. It's shot like that movie, was it Nick of Time, where everything's happening in real time?
Oh, no, Nick of Time was the Johnny Depp movie where he had only a certain amount of time to save his daughter's life.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the one? Was that shot in real time?
Yeah, I thought it was shot for real time. I haven't seen it in like forever, but this movie takes place in almost in real time.
Ooh, I like that.
And it's in one night in this small New Mexico town in the 50s. And the atmosphere of it, the set design, the dressing, the feel of it is so 1950s, and it's framed in almost a Twilight Zone kind of way.
Cool.
And it goes into a little bit of, I'm going to say, Close Encounters Project Blue Book kind of way.
Yeah, that's what they said, is that it's got a Spielberg-y kind of vibe to it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, man. Good. Good to know that's validated. I'm all in on this now.
Cool.
I'll email you when I check it out.
Awesome. Well, Josh, thank you for sharing your Jaws.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Jaws. Yes, Josh's Jaws love. How's that? That's a tongue twister for you.
Thank you for letting me be a part of this. This was outstanding. What an awesome day.
Oh, my pleasure. And yeah, I think we're done now. I could talk Jaws all day, as you see. But if you have any questions or comments, even on stuff that's not Jaws related, please feel free to call. The number is 602-635-6976, or shoot me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, on Google. Is it still Google Play or is it Google Podcasts now? They're changing stuff off, confusing me, making me have to jump through hoops. But either way, it's Google. We've come to expect this of them. Where else are we? We're on TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Podcasts, and Player FM. So go check us out wherever you subscribe to your podcasts. And if it's not any of those platforms, but you've found Slice of Sci-Fi, let me know. I'll add it to the list. And if you're listening on Apple or on Stitcher, please feel free to leave a review. Let people know you are enjoying the show and that they should check it out for themselves, especially for awesome interviews like this one. You can follow Slice of Sci-Fi on Twitter. We're at Slice of Sci-Fi. We're also on YouTube and Facebook. We're Slice of Sci-Fi there. And yes, we have a new video playlist, Creator Conversations. Go check that out. I'm still adding to it. And if you have suggestions, feel free to let me know. And of course, there's always the website, sliceofscifi.com, where you can see more interviews, more reviews, more commentary on sci-fi, horror, paranormal, comics. Come on by. Enjoy the stories we have for you. I'd like to thank everyone who is currently helping to support Slice of Sci-Fi and all of the podcasts and websites in the Slice of Sci-Fi orbit. Your support really does help keep things online, keep the lights on, so to speak, around here. If you would like to add your support, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. Or if a donation every now and then is more in your comfort level, the link to use is paypal.me/sci-fi summer. And yes, keep an eye out, you Patreon supporters. It's almost perks time. June 1st is coming up, so the June perks will be going out, even though the winner of the May perk has not gotten back to me yet. We have books, we have advanced copies of books, we have DVDs, we have Blu-rays, all sorts of stuff that needs to go to new homes. So if you're a supporter, keep an eye out on your Patreon messages. But that'll do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening, and we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.